Hello?
That was a cool thing about the 80s, you know, like, all those movies were like that.
One way or another, I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you one way or another.
Every one of my games, I try to do something brand new.
One way or another, I'm gonna see you.
Best time to get someone, man, when they're well fed and had a couple of wines. Welcome to the Retro Project Podcast. My name is Steve and I am your host. Now today's episode is part two of our chat with Tim Laptino. Tim is the author of The Art of Atari. He's also been involved with The Art of Street Fighter and has a few of his own really interesting projects coming up very soon. He does go into those in these episodes. So if you haven't heard part one, head back into iTunes, download the first part and then come back and join us for part two. Tim will be with us in just a moment, but I would like to let you know where you can find us across the intraweb. First, you can find us on Twitter at Retro Project Pod. You can find us on Facebook at Retro Project Pod. And you can also send us an email to theretroprojectpod@gmail.com. Now, at the end of this episode, I will also be letting you know who our next guest is going to be. I'm really excited about this one. It was a great episode. It was a lot of fun to record. And the guy is an absolute legend in the field of comic books. So that's the only hint that you're getting until the end of the episode. Now, if you like what you're hearing, please go into iTunes, leave us a review. It only takes 30 seconds, and it really does help the show. That's enough for me for now. So, let's start chatting with Tim.
Really awesome to be able to connect the dots with those kinds of things that we've grown up with and, you know, are now, you know, so iconic.
Did you ever get to see or did anyone go into any kind of great detail with you about the Mind Band?
Just a little bit. Yeah, the Mind Link controller.
Oh, the Mind Link. That was it. The Mind Link. For back in the day, that was a pretty out there concept.
Yeah.
Now, for people who don't know what it is, it's a thought-controlled controller, basically, to put it in the simplest terms. And did anyone come to you with this or did you approach other people with it or was it something that there was just not a lot of information about?
There was a little bit. You know, I talked to Roger Hector, who was, pretty involved in the R&D, you know, and we talked a bit about that. The idea that, you know, until Warner really started shooting some of this down, they had a very healthy R&D budget and they were always trying to push the envelope. That was very much the spirit of Nolan Bushnell is trying to see what was next. And, they said, how can we control these things in a different way? Now, you know, the idea that it was mind control was very, it's probably disingenuous a little bit, obviously. You know, it was basically electrical impulses. You know, you'd furrow your brow and kind of move your forehead around, you know, and that was how you control this thing. It was a capacity. It was like, and I'm not an engineer, but my understanding, it was, you know, it has a capacitive quality to it so that the electrical impulses, when you move your forehead, this thing would do that. But, you know, try doing that and, you know, furrowing your brow and raising and lowering your eyebrows and moving your head around, you know, it very quickly gave people headaches. And, it was very difficult to do it consistently. But, you know, like you give them credit for, you know, really spinning it, really that it had a great story behind it. Yeah, it didn't really work and it didn't make it out of the early prototype stage, but they were doing all kinds of things like that. And I love that, you know, and I think that that spirit was very, very cool. You know, and sure, they had some misses, but they also had a lot of hits. I mean, you look at other things that never happened, like the Cosmos holographic, game console that never saw the light of day. I mean, that probably would have sold pretty well. I mean, Atari, they were very, that was probably, you know, a strength and a weakness of theirs is that sometimes they were distracted by all these other things, but there was a really healthy spirit of R&D, and I think that really comes across.
Conceptual was something that was pretty big with Atari, even just in the games. I mean, I remember the first time I played Sword Quest. I had absolutely no idea what was going on. The thing with Sword Quest was obviously a lot of the game was explained within the comic book. Our Sword Quest itself, the entire Sword Quest story is almost a story on itself. But what happened is when the Atari Sword Quest cartridge came out in Australia, they didn't have the rights to publish the comic book.
Oh.
He received the cartridge with no comic book whatsoever. Now, this is another example of Atari artwork being absolutely amazing. The cover of Earthworld. You know, you've got the guy with the pirate patch. You've got the Minotaur in the background. You've got the two heroes on the front. And it was the first Atari cartridge that I ever received that came in the silver box.
Uh-huh.
Trust me, without that comic book,
oh, totally.
The Sword Quest games make absolutely no sense. But the concept behind it was brilliant. The story of Sword Quest, the story of the competition, whatever happened to the final prizes, you know, how far would it have gone? The interviews that you read with the guys who actually won the individual contest. Now there was two winners, wasn't there? Because they didn't do
right.
They didn't do three and four.
No, that's exactly right.
In your travels, anyone ever mention what happened to the final sword?
No, you know, there was a couple stories that I heard. You know, some people claim that you know, one of the Tremels had it in their house, but I think it was just another sword. You know, somebody said, "Oh, I saw a sword at their house." You know, sitting on this, you know, hung on the mantle or something like that. But from my understanding is that since those were not issued, that they ended up being returned to the, you know, was it the Franklin Mint, I think, who created all of those. And I think at the time, the Franklin Mint was actually owned by Warner Communications as well. So I think those ended up getting just melted down and destroyed and used for something else. But, you know, part of the language of the contract is if those prizes were not awarded, you know, they were basically going to be destroyed and never just handed out.
That was a pretty big deal back in the day, of a video game
offering
$25,000 prizes. And these weren't small things. You had the ones which actually got given away, if I'm right, were the chalice and the amulet.
Yep, that's right.
Were the two which actually went out. And then there was a crown, and the fourth one was like a philosopher's stone or something.
Right.
You know, you're talking about $100,000 worth of prizes all up for playing video games. You can make a money as a professional gamer nowadays, but this must have been the first time that someone had kind of actually put something of such value on the line for playing video games.
Yeah, isn't that funny? It's like, you know, talking with Todd Fry, you know, who designed those games, like he wanted it to be this epic quest that, you know, mashed up all these different, you know, religions and like mystical and schools of thought and all this stuff. And I think the contest was even his idea as well. So I, you know, it almost feels like it's this echo of esports now, where there's a lot of money on the line to be made being a professional video gamer. It's pretty cool.
The thing with yourself as well is it's, you haven't just done the Art of Atari book. You've also brought out a Street Fighter book.
Yeah, you know, after Art of Atari, it was, you know, which was very successful and the publisher was really happy with it. They said, hey, you know, what other properties can we give this treatment to? And so we sort of bandied around some names, and then, you know, they started reaching out and making connections. And Capcom, you know, was very interested with Street Fighter V coming out, really looking back on that. And for us, it was like, you know, that was really interesting. So I didn't write that one, but I edited and art directed it. And a friend of mine is Steve Hendershot. Wrote that, and he did a phenomenal job. I mean, he went to Japan. He really went into great detail and, you know, getting all these great interviews and really telling the story of, you know, sort of the birth of modern esports and really more about like how these games came to be. So I think for me, it was like, I still had that connection because I obviously played those games growing up. But for me, it was also like, okay, we can write video game histories, you know, till the cows come home. But where are the places that, you know, there were really innovative things done? What are things where those creators really have stories to tell? And we felt like Street Fighter was definitely one of those.
Now, how are you with Street Fighter? Are you a good player? Are you someone who can hand it to other people? How do you go with it?
No, I'm a pretty weak player, you know, which works out well because in doing that book, you know, Steve and I played a decent amount of Street Fighter, and a big, you know, we had a lot of, unlike Art of Atari, you know, we had a lot of access to the Capcom archives. But, you know, I mean, we really went for it in that book, and we really wanted to talk, you know, look at in depth in sort of all these special moves and really dig into some of the biggest ones of all the main characters and even the minor characters. So that meant very specific screenshots of all these different moves and writing about them. And so that wasn't something that existed in the Capcom archives. So Steve and occasionally I did, it was mostly Steve, you know, had to sit down and play and screen cap these games. And he had to execute the move competently and do it in a way that we could use the imagery for it. And, you know, his wife actually is now a pretty good Street Fighter player too, you know, just out of necessity. Cause you know, they would sit and play and screen cap all this stuff. And we had these big spreadsheets of checklists of, okay, do we have that move for this character? Do we have this one, you know? I'm really glad that it's him, not me. Cause, I would still be playing right now trying to screen cap those moves. I'm really glad it wasn't me.
With that in mind, is there a game out there that you really love, but you're just no good at? Like you'll go to it every single time, and every single time you just go, I just suck at this game.
Yeah, you know, I think for me, I really would like, I mean, I'm a classics guy, you know, and as soon as you get past like the, you know, the NES era, I'm a terrible gamer. But I think, you know, the game that I want to be better at, I would love to be a great Pac-Man player. But I'm just not the kind of guy. My brain does not work. I can't memorize patterns like that. You know, that's why I'm a designer and not a, you know, not a programmer or something like that. I don't have that analytic brain. So I wish I could be a lot better Pac-Man player, but I'm not. I love the game. I like playing it, but I'm just not that great at it.
With the Art of Atari book and the Art of Street Fighter book, mm-hmm. And you mentioned that your degree and your trade is actually journalism. Are you finding that you're starting to travel more down this niche of writing for video games and being called on for an opinion with video games or that kind of thing? Or is it something that takes up a little bit of your time and you're still pursuing other...
You know, it's a little bit of both, actually. You know, like I said, you know, there's some people who are just, they love the whole idea of video games. They're, you know, champions of the industry. And I'm not, you know... I'm sort of somebody that's adjacent to the video game industry, but you know, I'm a classics guy. So, you know, people ask me, well, what do you think about, you know, this franchise or this new game? And I said, you know, I'm way out of my depth when you ask me about that. But that being said, you know, this Atari is well known. And so I have become something of an expert on this very, very narrow topic of, you know, Atari history and Atari art and design. And, you know, I'll still routinely get calls, you know, the people who own Atari now are crowdfunding launching a new console. I've gotten multiple, you know, press requests, people asking me what I think of that, you know, and all I have is a historical perspective. But, you know, that's apparently worthwhile. So I am in the interesting position of being somebody who's been a lifelong Atari fan. And then through the course of researching and writing this book, I feel like I've become something of an expert of the Atari history, but there's plenty of people who know way more than me. I just happen to be a little bit more visible. But in terms of books, I think I probably have a couple more video game books in me that maybe the market would bear. But for me, it's always been about, you know, where video games intersect with art and design and where they sort of influence pop culture. You know, if we were talking about, you know, people ask me, you know, after this book came out, so are you going to do the Art of Intellivision next? And I'm saying, like, I dislike that system. I thought it was a terrible system. I have no fondness for those games. And it's a super niche project, you know, product that compared to Atari had a very little reach. You know, so like that's a non-starter for me. You know, it's nothing against the Intellivision. That's cool. People like it. But for me, that's not the book that I would write. You know, so for me, I like connecting it to the larger culture, pop culture, the history of how these things affect culture, but also the design side. So a book that I am working on, and I don't know how much this is news, I still don't have it's not a finalized thing, but I'm working on a book about the history and potentially the art and design of Pac-Man.
That is definitely a subject with a lot of legs right there. So how far into that are you at the moment? Is that an idea that you're throwing around? Have you started the research for it? Have you kind of got a rough copy of what you're doing? Can I have it?
Yes. Yeah, so I have started working on it. I mean, it's a big process. You know, this book, you know, it would be a little bit in the future if and when it does come out. Like things still need to be finalized. There's not a publisher yet. We're still working through some things on that side, but I'm hopeful. I think it's one of those things that will happen. But for me, it's like Pac-Man is like pop culturally. Pac-Man is one of the stalwarts. Everyone knows Pac-Man, even though Pac-Man's almost 40 years old. He's got a cultural presence, you know, long beyond any of the actual games. We were talking about our kids. I went in for my daughter's kindergarten class. It was like a career day, you know, and I said, you come in and talk about what you do. And I talked about how I've written, books about video games. And I said, okay, you know, how many of you guys play video games? All, 5 and 6 year olds, all their hands go up. And I said, okay, how many of you know who Pac-Man is? All of those hands go up. And it just absolutely blew me away because these are kids who, you know, there's some new Pac-Man video games. You know, there's things out there in the arcades, but these are little kids. You know, there's not a Saturday morning cartoon necessarily that's tied to them. I know there's an animated series floating out there, but it's not right in their face in pop culture. It's not like some of these other things that are more popular, like, you know, Ninjago or Legos or, you know, something like that. You know, this is a somewhat obscure, but yet they all know who Pac-Man is on sight, you know, and I think that really speaks to the cultural penetration of this property. And I think Pac-Man, because of the game and how simple the game is, but also like how visually, how iconic it is, there's something about Pac-Man. You can reduce Pac-Man so far down and it's still Pac-Man. There's some kind of interesting, irreducible quality visually of Pac-Man. And also you see, you know, Pac-Man is showing up in Super Bowl ads and, commercials, 40 years later. And that's a topic that I'm really excited about tackling from all these different angles, not just the history and the making of the game, but how, you know, researchers are using the Miss Pac-Man game to train AI, you know, how, microbiologists are crafting, microorganisms and they need them to run through some kind of maze. So what do? They're going to recreate the Pac-Man maze. I mean, it's embedded in the culture in a way that probably no other game is.
It must be a little bit daunting because there's always going to be someone who goes, well, what about this thing with Pac-Man? And what about this thing with Pac-Man? And there's not one company that you can go to do the research on this book, is there? Like you were saying, Namco for Street Fighter, Atari for the Art of Atari. This is probably going to be the most challenging one that you've done so far, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it is. But I think that's the thing that's exciting to me is like, you know, I will, you know, be able to interview a microbiologist and an AI specialist. And I think, you know, I tracked down the person who directed the Bud Light commercial I think this was last year, 2 years ago, during the Super Bowl, they had a guy run through a physical Pac-Man maze, you know, and I really want to talk about like, okay, why, you know, and that's what I want to know is like, why does Pac-Man persist? So it's kind of exciting because you get to touch all kinds of areas. And I think that it's sort of what you make it. So I'm really hoping in the same way that, you know, we kind of broke ground with the Atari book that, you know, there really hasn't been a definitive or a really extensive book about the history and the cultural impact of Pac-Man. And I'm excited to be able to do that because I think it doesn't just take somebody who knows video games. I think you've got to understand the larger cultural context. So, and that's probably the most boring way to say it, but I'm really excited to tackle that in that way. It definitely keeps me, it's been running in the background, for me for a couple of years really now. And I've been doing a little bit of research here and there. So I've managed to start squirreling away information and interesting things. And I think it's going to hopefully lead to a really, really interesting book that maybe even more so than Art of Atari will be something that, you know, you don't need to have much of a pedigree in video games to pick this up and be interested in it.
The thing I love most about it is it's coming from a guy who was there, you know, as all of these different iterations were coming out and as the cartoon came out and as the music came out and so Pac-Man has probably, I imagine, always in some way been a part of your life.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I had Pac-Man sheets. I think I had the sleeping bag. You know, I remember as a like 6 year old going to a, you know, some kind of birthday party where you're making crafts and I painted a, you know, some kind of plaster Pac-Man because I loved Pac-Man, you know, and I brought it home and that was my pencil holder. It's actually, I still have it, you know, it's sitting on my daughter's shelf. And, you know, it feels like Pac-Man has always been sort of weaving in and out of my own story. So in some ways, yeah, you're right. you know, Pac-Man's just a couple years younger than me. So it's like Pac-Man's story is also my story. So it's pretty fun.
Now, is there anything else that you'd like people to know about what you've got coming up or where they can find you or anything along those lines? Anything you want to plug?
Cool. Awesome. No, that's great. I appreciate it. And then one other book that I'm working on, you know, and this is, again, this is my interest of pop culture and design and where they interact. I'm writing a book about the illustrator Arthur Radabaugh. And this was a guy who in the 40s, 50s, and 60s was an illustrator, mostly in the Detroit area. He did a lot of automotive illustration and advertising work, but all of his work has a real interesting futuristic look to it, you know, by way of the 50s and 60s. And he even did a Sunday comic strip that ran for almost 4 years called Closer Than We Think. And it was all about what the future was going to be like, you know, whether it was milkmen with rocket packs or triple-decker buses or bases on the moon. You know, he had this really, really interesting and sort of positive futurism. You know, the idea that technology was really going to, you know, change us. And it was a really specific vision of the future. So he's kind of criminally under, you know, really under the radar and almost unknown. And I'm really hoping with a book that sort of expands all his work that I'll help bring him back into the spotlight a little bit.
Is this the guy who it looks like a lot of the Jetsons
yes.
took their vision of the future from what he drew?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Is this the guy that you're talking about? Because he is everywhere.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
the name isn't known.
Yeah, the name isn't, but his art is around there. Yeah, he definitely is. You know, I can't draw, at least not yet, I can't draw a specific line from the Jetsons to this artist, but his stuff definitely, like, you could see this and see a conceptual through line.
Yeah, I remember buildings with roads wrapped around them.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, it is really interesting, and it's funny how his work has really permeated the culture without people even realizing it was him. I don't know if you remember the movie, it's about more than 10 years old now, almost 15. Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow.
I'm a huge fan of that film. Love the look of it.
Yeah. Oh, that looks amazing. And all of the concepts, you know, I recently interviewed Kevin Conran, who's the art director with his brother, who's the director of that film. And he, you know, we talked about it because I said, hey, you know what, are you aware of this artist? He said, aware of him. You know, Arthur Radabaugh is one of the people who really influenced me in terms of design for this movie. And they're both, you know, Detroit area guys. So we had a lot of great conversations about that and what, you know, Radabaugh's work kind of means to the culture and it just means in general. So that's pretty fun. I mean, even today you see, you know, his influence.
So it sounds like your plate is pretty full moving forward.
Yeah, it is. It is. And there's way more ideas than there are time to execute them. But, you know, that's a good problem to have.
John Lennon said something along the lines of, you know, life is what happens when you're busy planning other things.
Yeah.
And where can people find you on the intraweb?
Yeah, right now I tweet at Lapetino. So it's Lapetino. It's just my name. And I'm also learning Instagram. I'm trying to get better about being on Instagram. I'm also on Facebook as well. And one of these days when I, you know, take a little time, I will get a proper website up and launched. But for now, you know, social media is kind of where I'm at.
No worries at all. Well, thank you so much for having a chat with me today, Tim. I could keep going. I could just go through the Art of Atari and the Street Fighter book page by page and ask you a question about every single page. But I'm not gonna take up that much of your time. As you said, time is a thing which is pretty precious for you at the moment. I do appreciate you taking the time to speak to us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Steve. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed the talk.
And that's the end of our chat with Tim. As you can tell, Tim is a really, really cool guy, and he really does know his stuff. Tim mentioned in the episode that he was building his website. Well, that website is now online, so you can actually go and check out a lot of Tim's stuff at www.timlapetino.com. As he said, you can also find him on Twitter, and he's on Facebook as well. So please go there, follow Tim, and you'll be able to keep up to date with all the amazing projects that he's got coming out. Now, our next episode is with a guy who is absolutely legendary in the field of comic books. This is a guy who has had his hands in some of the greatest stories which have been written. We're talking Spider-Man, we're talking Justice League, we're talking Moonshadow. We are talking J.M. DeMatteis. So J.M. will be with us in the next episode. To catch that episode, make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes. You can find us on the intraweb. We are on Twitter at Retro Project Pod. We are on Facebook at Retro Project Pod. And you can send us an email at theretroprojectpod@gmail.com. You can also find all of our episodes on iTunes. We're talking episodes with Tim Latino, Howard Scott Warshaw, and we've got some absolutely amazing guests lined up for the future as well. So make sure you subscribe to us so that you don't miss any of these amazing episodes. Until next time, thank you for listening, and this has been the Retro Project Podcast.